For our next speaker, we have Nikolai, who will be talking about some sexy SSH hacks. Make sure to give him a round of applause.
All right, so hopefully you are ready for 45 minutes of a random SSH talk. Yeah. So, question, how many people have used SSH before? A lot of people, great. If you haven't used SSH before, this is going to be very boring. How many have used it within the last month? And a week? Today? Okay, a lot of people, great. So I use SSH maybe not on a daily basis, but at least on a weekly basis. And I probably use it the same way as you use it, you know, SSH into a random server and, you know, run a few commands, maybe copy, paste a file, all the like usual stuff. And I've been using SSH for quite some time. And then 3 years ago, I was sitting in the pajamas camp and we were creating, you know, these weird machines. And then I found out you can actually make a like a snake game in the login prompt of SSH. So that looks, yeah, this is like some time ago, that looks like this. So that kind of like piqued my interest in SSH, and I was like, what else can I do? And just for the fun of it, let's actually try to demo it. So SSL, snake, add whatever. And then when I log in, it normally you can log in with a username password, right? You can log in with a public key where you sign something, but you can also send this like challenge response. I think that's pretty cool because then your challenge can just be, you know, the full game state. And as you can see, I cannot actually render NC escape codes, but I'm pretty sure 3 years ago at my setup at that time it worked. So if this works for you and you don't get that weird like escape code in the top, then I would love to see your setup because then it should actually work for you. And you can see I'm kind of just, you know, my answer to the game state is a, you know, arrow down and then enter, and then I can, you know, play a snake. And it's, you know, a bit broken, but kind of works. I think that is very cool, and I kind of like building these weird machines. So let me go back. All right, so this is the agenda. As I said, for the last about 3 years, I've just been writing down, you know, fun, cool hacks from Hacker News and so on. And then try to you know, merge them into a presentation. And then 2 weeks ago, somebody asked me, so whenever you say SSH, you mean SSH 2.0, right? What is SSH 1? I was like, oh shit, I have no idea. So a bit of a story also. All right, so who am I? My name is Nicolas Søvold. I have the domain sub.org, which is a bit weird because you have to puny code it. So if you see this weird XN whatever domain, that is my domain. I love doing weird hacks, making snake game as a login prompt, and I also like to play capture the flag. I think that's a very nice way to have a like a useful way of, or like a good reason to spend, you know, 3 hours reading an RFC. Anyways, what is SSH 1.0? So if you look up the spec, the SSH 2.0 spec, you find this quote saying that, you know, the best documentation is in the source code of a specific client of SSH 1.0, and then there's a link to an FTP server, and this is, you know, 20 years ago. So I was a bit, you know, I wonder if I can find it. But surprisingly, and you know, this is why I love the internet, right? You just FTP into the web server, and for 20 years they have been hosting, you know, a random version of the source code of SSH 1.0, and drinking games going back all the way to 1993. So that's, I mean, that's fucking cool. And I hope that in 20 years from now, we can still find the source code of, you know, old deprecated software. Architecture-wise, I read a bit on SSH 1.0, but I was like, it's not so interesting. And from a very high level perspective, there's not a lot of changes. Like there's, you know, another hash function, another format of input outputs and so on, but that's not the fun part. I think the more fun part about SSH 1.0 is kind of like, why do we have SSH 1.0? You know, this is almost before my time, right? So I don't have any memory of it, but apparently before SSH you had RSH and RCP and so on, right? Where you could copy paste a file, and it, you know, it would do what you expect it to do, just, you know, without any encryption. Yay. Then came NSA and Let's Encrypt, and And today it's another time, right? So of course we want to encrypt our communication. So that's the kind of like the main diff, let's say it like that, right? You just add to your list to something else. All right. Yeah. So let's look at SSH from an IFC perspective. And if you go to the IFC spec, you see there's like three main parts of it. So it's very simple, right? You connect to a server, you do a DPL man key exchange dance, and then you have a secure connection to the server. Then you have a protocol for authentication. And then finally, when you have this secure authenticated protocol, you can split that into multiple logical channels, right? So you can do port forwarding, you can do X11 forwarding, you can have a shell. I'll mostly be focusing on like the two top parts. All right, so the way I like to approach a new protocol is just, you know, to play around with it. Before I would never start reading the RFC, I would just, you know, connect to it. So what happens when you just connect to an SSH server? Let's try it. Right. So let's kill it. So netcat, my server, port 22. Right. So I didn't really know what to expect. Right. I would maybe expect a bunch of binary stuff, but actually you get a text string, and then if you put something in, you get another text string out. Right. So I went and looked at the spec, and the spec tells you, oh, this is the format of the banner, right? You need to see this from the server, and then you know as a client that you can connect to it. And already now, from a security point of view, this is something you need to pass, right? You need to look at, you know, what is the maximum length of the line. Also, what if you get a line that doesn't start with SSH1? Then the spec tells you, no, just, you know, continue reading a line. So you can set up a bunch of fun stuff. You can set up something called like the project name is awesome, right? Endless SSH that just continues sending a banner forever. And then if your client doesn't time out stop after some amount of time, it will just continue being stuck trying to connect forever, right? So maybe if you all set this up, then you know you'll have no spammers on the internet. just kidding. another thing you can do with this is that you have these polyglot files. So you have a file where if you pass it as a PNG, it's a valid PNG with stuff in the end. And if you pass it as a zip file, which you pass from the bottom, right, it's a valid zip file with stuff in the front you just ignore. And you can kind of do the same with SSH. You can have an SSH server sending a banner being like, I'm an HTTP server. And if you're an HTTP client, you'll just read, you know, the length of the body and then you'll stop. And if you are an SSH client, you will just ignore the banner, and then you will continue connecting. So I tried to set that up the other day, and it works surprisingly well. So if you do the same, now we could try to just curl it on port. I didn't know what port to use, so I used 422. I think that's a pretty nice port for SSH and HTTP. So I curl it, I get, you know, a valid reply back. It's just a web server, right? But if I instead of curling it, I do SSH on this port, then it's an SSH server. Yeah. So this is not very useful, right? But it's just fun to play around with the protocol, and In a way, it's also a bit scary, right? Because this is maybe not something that should be fun to play around with. It's maybe not something that should be flexible, right? So I think one takeaway is if you design software like this, maybe you should be more restrictive, right? Like maybe the banner is just one line int, or you know, no, you know, infinite amount of text can just be there, right? So yeah, polyglot, don't do that. All right, but let's not, you know, get ahead. Let's go back a step, right? So I connect, I get a banner, I assume there's no malicious stuff. How do I turn, you know, my connection into a secure connection? All right, so I do the normal Diffie-Hellman dance, right? I generate a secret, the server generates a secret, just like a number. You combine the number with maybe a generator on a field, and then you get a public key. The public key is random. Both the public keys are random, right? You have a secret. You send only the public keys, holy Moses, and then And then if you have a passive attacker, they can only see the public keys, and you cannot turn the public key. You have to, you know, combine a secret key with a public key to turn it into the shared secret. So with this setup, we know that any passive attackers will be defeated, but there could be an active attacker just replacing the key. And in this case, I basically only get a secure connection between me and somebody, right? Me and an attacker, active attacker, or me or the actual server. So what happens afterwards is that the server will take its other public key and sign this transaction. And then you can kind of, the server can prove to me that this, whatever random public key I get, is actually, you know, signed by the actual server key. But how do I trust the actual server key? So there's a pretty nice quote from the RFC. This is from, I think it's from 2006 or something, right? So it tells you this whole kind of like, you need to map a server name into a public key. And how do you do that? Well, I mean, you can have like a database of public keys, the known host file. You can use a certificate authority kind of setup like we do with TLS. Or you can trust the key on first use, right? Which is what we normally do, right? We see a random key, you just do like, yes, I believe this key is good. And then you save the hash of the key for next time. But then the spec tells us like, oh, but at some point, you know, in the future, of course, somebody will create a wildly deployed key infrastructure that we can just use. And this is, again, like 20 years ago, and we don't really have a good PKI, or do we? So I'll probably not be very popular in this tent, but we actually do have a wildly deployed PKI. We have DNSSEC, which everybody loves to hate, but it's actually a pretty cool setup. So if my domain name is signed by DNS, and I put my public key in DNS, then I can just distribute it. And there's a spec for that. And the format is fairly simple, right? You have a dedicated DNS record where you put in the algorithm of the key and then the type of the fingerprint. I would say when I read a lot of the spec, and the SSH is very flexible. Like whenever you can have multiple types, you will be able to have multiple types, right? It's never just, you know, hash it with this algorithm. It's always have a type of the hash, and then, you know, yeah. It stuff is a bit complicated, right? But this is how it looked originally on my setup, right? So I have my domain name, I have multiple keys on my server, because that's the default. Then I, you know, pick one of the keys, host, DSA, whatever, I hash it, and then I put in the hash in DNS. Then in my local config, I can say, please look up DNS, make sure that the DNS record is authenticated, and then stuff should just work without the known host file, and no trust on first use. So let's try that. Whoops. Dick. And my domain name, whoops. So first of all, you'll see I don't have like many keys left. I only have like a single key. And I think that's a very sane default. Like just if you don't need, I think by default, you know, your SSH server, whatever, will come with like multiple keys of types and so on. You know, just delete the three of them and see if it still works. So in this case, I'm using a type 4 key, which I think when I took the screenshot was not a thing. So it's still a very evolving setup. So this is one of these fancy ED255119 keys. And then you see I have a hash of the key. So if I go to my SSH folder and my known host, this one, and just kill it, right? Then now I have no idea about any server fingerprints. But if I try to log into my website, then hopefully, okay, damn. And it doesn't work because I don't have my key added. It's because I have another demo later. Demo gods, please. What is my password? is it not that one? It should be that one. Okay, wait. I know my passwords. Okay, awesome. So what I'm trying to do, I'm trying to SSH in, right? But I have no idea what the fingerprint should be. And hopefully, it's a bit slow, I'll get in, right? So that is pretty awesome. And what happens if you try to then authenticate to something without the without a fingerprint in DNS? Let's take this one. Then you'll get the normal, you know, prompt saying here's a fingerprint of this server's key. I have no idea. Do you want to trust on first use? I can be yes, no, whatever. And what happens if I try to log into a broken setup? Then I'll get this big fat warning saying, you know, I actually found a fingerprint and the fingerprint is wrong, right? So like an even bigger error message. But I think this is a nice setup because if you manage a lot of servers, at least in my experience, every now and then you might change the key for various reasons or you might lose your known host file or whatnot. So it is, you know, instead of just being yes, then you know, try to put it in DNS. It's pretty cool. All right. Yes. Okay, so what is the requirement, right? You need a DNS provider that supports this very specific record type, right? SSH FP. So that's a bit annoying. Then you need to trust DNS, right? So you need DNSSEC on your domain and on your client. And then, I don't know how many people used gratis DNS, but they changed to 1.com. And 1.com did not support SSH FP. And they you know, this change occurred while I was testing around and changing my key. So I was stuck with this, you know, forever warning because I cannot change my DNS record because I'm stuck on a provider that does not support it. And I'm using a new key. So that was a bit annoying. But anyways, they support it now, which is pretty cool. All right, so going back a bit, right? So I'm connecting to a server, we're doing the Diffie-Hellman dance, I'm trusting the key because I have some way of trusting it, what then, right? So I have a shared secret, the stuff below, in the bottom of the picture before, and so for some of the next slides, I just have some stuff, you know, I like about SSH and some stuff I don't like. So what I like is they have this exchange hash. So the key, of course, you never would, don't ever share that, right? Don't put it in log files, don't do stuff like that. But you would love to have a way to like reference to the key. So it's a very simple protocol setup, right? You just be like, here's the key, that's secret, hash the key, and then this is public. I think that's a pretty nice setup because then you can like refer to this, you know, temporary setup we have. Then next, we kind of like want to split this key into multiple keys. And what SSH does is it just hashes together, you know, this secret key with, you know, the letter A, the letter B, the letter C, and so on. I kind of like this setup. It's pretty simple. Probably, like, if you should design a new SSH 3.0, whatever, you should use a real key deviation function. But I mean, this is a pretty neat, easy setup. But there's something a bit weird, right? Why do I need so many keys? Right? It's quite a lot of keys. And that's the next thing, right? So the spec tells you you need to, like, you do have a secure connection. You have a bunch of, you know, packages with control messages going back and forth, and then you agree on should we compress data, which type of cipher should we use, and so on. And the spec tells you you must be able to, you know, independently of the direction, change the selected cipher and compression and so on. So it's perfectly valid for me to send compressed AES to my server and then get uncompressed DES encrypted data back. And that's super, super weird. But it's valid SSH. Again, I would love to see this being removed from the spec. Just, you know, it should be the same. I should never want to use one cipher going to my server and then another cipher going back. Okay, so I can encrypt data, but how do I know somebody is not going to just, you know, do random bit flips? Right, AES does not protect against bit flips. at least, you know, I can do some stuff with it. So the underlying protocol is called the binary package protocol in SSH, and the format is quite simple. It's, you know, you encrypt some data, and then you have a message authentication code giving you integrity after the encrypted data, and then, you know, this inner package is just, you know, the length of the package, the length of some padding, and then the package, and then the padding. So it looks like this. And this is a very weird setup, because how do we parse it? So you get some ciphertext, but you maybe don't know how much ciphertext you need. And the only way to figure out is if you decrypt the first block. And then you can, after you have decrypted the first block of the ciphertext, you can figure out, I need to read a few more packages, and then you can check the MAC. But that means I can now do, I can start tampering with the first part of the of whatever this is, right? Because you have no idea how to check it without just decrypting it, and then you can do these kind of active attack against the cipher. For instance, if I want to decrypt a package that contains all F, or I believe it's like FFFFFFF, and I put that as the first package, and you decrypt it, and you figure out, oh, so the length must be FFFFF. So you just continue reading data from the wire until, you know, you get FFFFF data, which of course won't happen, right? But if it's 0000, then, you know, that there should be no more data, so you can check the MAC will fail, and you close the connection. So now you can do these attacks where you can at least guess some stuff from the cipher. This is called encryption and macking, and it's a bit kind of like in, I would say, 2000 wipes, where you didn't really know how to do it, right? There's also encryption then macking, which is almost the same. What you should do is called, mac then encrypt. What you should do is encrypt then mac, ETM. And in ETM, you just do the order a bit different, but now, you need to, now you can check the MAC before you even try to decrypt data. But this requires the length to be public, right? But the length is already a bit public, right? Because you already need to know, if you are an attacker, you can just, you know, look at the length of the encrypted data on the wire. So it doesn't really leak anything. And if you want to enable this, then you can configure your server and your client to accept only ciphers ending with ETM. So you'll also see that in my config later, that you can just go in and enable this, right? So this is an OpenSSH extension. So it's not part of the original spec, but it's a much better way of doing it. So there's another, a cool trick actually SSH does, which is that the MAC is not only the, I was lying a bit here, right? It's not only the inner part of the message. It's actually a sequence number and then the inner part of the message. And the sequence number is not sent over the wire, but it's just, a counter going up. And the idea here is that if you reorder packages, then the sequence number will be incorrect. And then you can detect somebody reordering packages. This is pretty neat, but I read a lot of, message threads about people being a bit annoyed, because it also means that the input to the MAC function is not the same as the input to the encryption function. So if you want to replace all of this with just AES in GCM mode, which is authenticated, then you have this, a bit annoying thing where you need to, you're not encrypting the same stuff as what you're actually checking. It's not an issue, it's just a bit annoying. So yeah, somebody spent a long time on that. All right, so I have a way to connect to a server. The server, we agree with, we generate a secure channel. I can authenticate that the server is actually who it tells me it is. But the server have no idea who I am. So you need to now go to the next step, the authentication protocol. And in the authentication protocol, you select a method, and there's of course a few more in later extensions. What I find pretty fun is that password authentication is not required. So it's valid, again, to be an SSH server and be no, I don't want to do passwords. I think that's pretty cool. I guess most people the first time you use SSH, you have a username and password. But actually, you can be like, I only want to support public keys. Another thing is you can also have a non method, so you can just connect to the server, be like, I'm root, and I don't need to authenticate who I am. Of course, the server is not going to allow that, right? But it is technically valid for the server to be like, okay, I guess. So you have this ping pong flow where you get like a list of the server can tell you, oh, but you need public key and a password. Or for the snake game I did initially, you have this like challenge response method, and for every like reply you get from the server, the server can tell you that you had a partially success when you logged in. So you, for instance, you'd be like, I would like to log in with this username and password. You log in, and then the server's like, that's good, but you need to prove a bit more. So you can also use this to have like two-factor when you log in. Of course, if you do two-factor, you should also have some kind of rate limits, right? Because it's very easy to brute force otherwise. And this is the request you sign if you use a public key. It's you know, fairly simple, right? You put in, I would like to do, like the service name is, I think, you know, if the difference between X11 forwarding and just a shell. You put in your username, then you put in your session identifier. That's the public part of the shared secret from before. So that's pretty cool, right? That kind of like binds this signature to the channel I have right now. That is, you know, generated uniquely to this session. And then I put my public key, and that's it. It's like one field missing from this one, which is not part of the spec, but it would have made the spec so much nicer. So I'm only signing that I'm now connecting to, you know, whatever this is. But if I connect to one server, and from that server I'd like to connect to another server, and to another server, and to another server, then these, which is agent forwarding, we'll talk about later, then all these signatures, they will be signed by my key on my laptop, but I don't know what I'm assigning. I'm just signing random session identifiers. So the other servers along the way, they can just be like, okay, you would like to connect to GitHub? Yes, just sign this signature, and then they actually are in the process of connecting to an internal server or whatnot. So this would have been much nicer if you had the public key of who you are actually connecting to. All right, and then there's a pretty nice project by a guy called Filippo, who has scraped all public GitHub keys. And then when you log into the server, I'll send my key. Whoops, that one, like the key in the bottom of it. And then he can just, you know, do like a reverse lookup, right? So this key must be somebody, and that works quite well. Let's try it. Where was his name? Filippo. Yes, I'd like to connect. And then, and he can look up that the key I have is connected to my GitHub, right? So that's very revealing. And you can actually also do the opposite, which is pretty cool. So when you connect to an SSH server, you can send a list of public keys, and then you can ask the server, which of these public keys works for this user on this account, on this system? And then the server can reply back saying, oh, the third key works. And the reason you can do that is because, let's say you have a physical hardware key you need to click to use. Then you don't want the user to click a bunch of hardware keys to find the right key that actually works. But it also means that, let's say I want to reveal some kind of a Tor hidden service, right? Then I might SSH into the hidden service, and then I might just, you know, start from the beginning of all the GitHub keys and try, like, can this key authenticate? Can this key authenticate? And then maybe I'll find a key, and then I can, you know, look up that somebody has access to might have access to a hidden service, like a public name. So that's, I think that's also a bit of a, I don't know if I like it or if I don't like it as part of the spec. I understand the idea, but I think it's a bit weird that you can actually query a server. The server can, of course, just lie, say like, no, none of the key works. But then if you actually use the key, it will work. Yeah. All right. So if I SSH from my system into another system, and then I would like to SSH from that other system and further along the way, then I probably don't want to copy paste my keys around. So I can use something called agent forwarding. And let's actually test that. So I have a demo system. On the demo system, I start an SSH agent. Then in my agent, I add one of my keys. So now I, you know, it's basically just a background process, right? Then if I, from this system, SSH into, to this system. Okay, so I'm, you know, from one system jumping into another system. And I'm forwarding my agent. Then from the terminal in the bottom, I'll jump to the second system directly. And from this system, I'm going to look at which file are in temp. So that's a few files, but nothing important, right? So from the top system, the demo box, I'm jumping into the Hexner box. And from the Hexner box, I now have a forwarded agent. So if I look at attempt again, I should be able to see an SSH folder. And if I go to that folder, then I can see that there is a socket available. So if I write something to this socket, it will be forwarded back from through the SSH connection back to the original box. And this is very dangerous, right? Because if I'm root on the bottom window, then I of course have access to the socket, right? The socket can only be protected by whoever the first user is. So that means that I can now, from the bottom, from the attacker's point of view, I can just ask the socket to sign a request on the behalf of the first user. And so the demo is a bit boring because you just set an environment variable and then you use all the normal SSH tools. So I'm not going to demo it. But what is cool is that in very new versions of OpenSSH, you can actually use something called agent restriction. The problem is agent restrictions require changes to all of your binaries, right? Like your SSH agent, SSH add, and SSH daemon. But if you have these newer versions, then you can specify a config like this. When I added the key, I just added to the agent, you know, this key is available for everybody to do basically everything, right? Sign stuff on my regard. With this new setup, I can tell the agent, when you get a request to sign something, you should actually check what you're signing. So in this case, I'm saying, if I'm trying to, like a common case, I think, would be, I'm often SSHing into my server, and for my server, I would like to SSH into GitHub, because I have my stuff on GitHub, right? But I don't want to copy my file, to my private key to my server. So it would be nice just to be, to add the restriction that the agent must only sign the user git on the domain git.data.coop, for instance. And if we go back like a ton of slides, you see that that's not possible with this format. So you need to change the format, right? I can only check the username, because this is the request I'm getting on my agent to sign. But with this new setup, you know, there are some changes to what I'm actually signing, which is why you need all the changes in the binaries. But then you can actually, you know, change these things. Another kind of like implementation detail is that it doesn't really make sense to restrict stuff on a hostname basis, because one key can have multiple hostnames. Or how do I kind of like check that? So what actually happens behind the scenes is that SSH add will look up what is the host key of all these domains and then add the restriction there. Right? This is fun and awesome, but it's very new, so it might not work. But if you can use it, then you should absolutely restrict stuff if you're going to forward your agent. And then you should absolutely only forward your agent if you must. Because it's very dangerous, because if somebody can attack the server you're SSHing into, then they can just ask your agent to sign anything. All right, so that's kind of like the first part of the presentation, and then let's go through some other, you know, random notes. First is, if you're using an ISA key, which you might be because that's the standard, then, you know, don't. This is ugly as fuck. Instead, you should generate a new key of type an elliptic curve key if you can. You get the same security level, it's just much smaller, which is very cool. And often it's much easier to actually implement. So absolutely do that. Yay. Next, you can do some pretty neat stuff with FIDO keys, like USB sticks, but also if you have the MID ID device, you can also use that. I forgot it, so I cannot show a demo with it. One bit annoyance is that often you cannot ask your FIDO key to be in the ED25519 format, which is the nicest by far. But you can often use ECDSA instead, which is almost the same, just sucks a bit more, but it's probably NIST whatever certified, so it works. The key will look like this when you generate it. So it has like SK, I think that stands for security key maybe. The key is very long because it actually contains a proof that, or it can contain a proof that it was signed on some hardware. So they are, you know, a bit long and annoying. You can also, I think, include in the key if you need to like physically click on the key to sign the request, or if you can just send the request to the key and then it will automatically sign. I was hoping that when they implemented this, they would do some kind of, you know, fancy, how do we cheat the key, because the FIDO2 standard is not very, that's meant for browsers, right? How do you like merge SSH into that? They're not doing anything fancy like trying to get the key to believe that it's actually signing a web request, but it's an OpenSSH request. They're just telling the key like what I showed before, what you're signing. You're signing something completely different if you're using one of these keys. So that's not very fun. You can most likely also use a TPM, which is very cool. I think this is from Ledger, the Bitcoin, crypto, whatever company. They have actually been pushing pretty hard for this. So the TPM standard is apparently very new. There's a tool called TPM2 PKCS11, which is the talk to a smart card standard. And it is most likely in your distro today. So I tried it before, and it worked super nice. And that's why my key was raining. So let's see. Go back here. So in this demo, I have no identities added to my SSH agent, meaning that it's going to fail when I log into stuff. And if I look in my SSH folder, you see that I have no keys in my folder. That's why I had to do the SSH add before. So you would very much expect that if I try to SSH into something, then that will fail. I have no keys on disk. So let's try it. And then it asked me for a PIN. And now in this case, SSH is a label in my TPM. And I really hope I can remember the key. And then it worked, right? So this is very cool. Now it means that if you hack my laptop, there's nothing to steal. You can ask my TPM live to sign something. But when I close down the screen or shut down the put out the battery, then I know that nobody can re-sign stuff on my behalf. Okay. There's a bunch of stuff that doesn't really work, or you get a bunch of error messages when you do it. But that's All right. So I have a bunch of random configs, and I'll go through them very quickly because I guess you all know them. So AESs are very cool, and let's actually look at my SSH config. SSH config. So AESs. I have a bunch of stuff that I just don't remember the name of. So you can add this maps to that, and then you can also tap completed. And you can have if you have weird options, then you can also add that to your config. Then if you ever do like a SCP and you copy paste a file, but you cannot remember what that path is again, then you should for sure look into multiplexing or control master. Let's see if we can do a good demo. So currently it is disabled. So if I go, let's remove all of this. Let's see. So what is the, I'm trying to tap complete. Oh, it's slow. Okay, that's a root. What's in root? So slow, right? Let's enable the control master. And let's try again. What's in root? It takes a long time to generate the first connection, but now I'm connected, so I should be able to easily see, be like, oh, there's a bunch of file in temp. I don't want to show my files, but I can actually pretty quickly tap complete stuff. And how does it work? Whoops. If I go to my SSH folder, I have a folder called control master. And in this folder, I just have a socket. And the socket, so whenever I need to create a new connection, it just looks in this folder, is there already a socket? You see that the socket is username at domain port. And that comes from the config. So I spent a lot of time debugging why like random option didn't work. And in my case, it was because I was adding the option down here, but I had a control master already open. So SSH did not know that I changed the options, right? So you see RP, RHP, whatever, you can add more stuff to that. And it probably should be much more like, I would love for this to be like a hash of everything, right? Every single option. So if I went down here and changed one of the options, it would automatically know that it has to create a new socket. That doesn't work. You easily get stuck on that. All right. And then you see this is to get the TPM working, adding all the ETM stuff. If you use Kitty, then you probably want to ask, automatically send environment variables to unbrick your terminal and so on. A lot of options. They are very nice. Look into it. Jump host, also, instead of first SSHing into something and then SSHing further along. All right, hardening. If you change all the configs I showed you, ETM, removing old ciphers, deleting old keys and so on, you probably will see this in your log. Random people trying to connect to a server to brute force, and then they can't even do like a key exchange. I think that's pretty cool. I hope some spammer somewhere is trying to debug why they also get where they were in their end. That would be fun. There's a very nice tool called SSH Our Audit, where you can test both your server and your client. They write something about, there's some ciphers made by NIST that I might be backdoored. I think that's a bit bullshit, but whatnot. And I tried to get recently there were this CV found in agent forwarding, and the idea was that if you do agent forwarding, then on So I'm on one server, I go to another server, and I have forwarded my agents, right? I have a socket that you can ask, you can use to ask my agent to sign something. That's bad by itself, but what if I, on this attacker system, could get my agent to do RCE? If I could do like a remote code execution on the original system. And then there are some people who found out that you know, there's a bug, it's written in C, surprise, surprise. But I couldn't get it to work, which was a bit annoying, right? But to get it to work, you would do the following. First, you'll steal the socket of whoever you are targeting. Then you can use SSH add to ask the agent on the target system to load a library. And apparently, there's no like restrictions on what library can you load. Or the only restriction is it has to be a library already on your system. And then they found out that if you install the right amount of packages from at least from you know, some Ubuntu packages, then you can actually get them to execute code by just loading and unloading them. And that's very amazing. So in this case, if you load this binary, then your stack will be executable. Then there are like there's a buffer overflow in some code, so you could store a bunch of stuff on the stack. Then if you load this library, there's a whatever signal handler that will be registered, but it'll point to some memory address. And then you unload the library, so now it points to nothing, right? Then you load this one, and it has some kind of no delete thingy, so now this SIG handler will point to some random place in this new library. You unload it, but it has no delete, so it's still there. And then if you load this one, it will trigger the signal handler. The signal handler will run some random code somewhere, which will end up jumping to your stack, and the stack is full of nops and then some code. So this was like, from a research perspective, super amazing. From an SSH perspective, it's not very relevant, right? If you do agent forwarding on a system that is already compromised, you have already lost. So very cool. Look into it. Final remarks. I was expecting the counter to be much higher, right? But I only lost access to my server one time for the last 3 years, and then I had the broken DNS. But if you play around with stuff, make sure you can get access, right? It's very easy to log yourself out of the system. And then final, when you go home and generate a bunch of new fancy ED 25519 keys, then you can use OpenSSH. SSH copy ID to just copy all your keys over to servers. This is a very nice tool. So you just, you know, copy all my keys to a new server, and then you're good. So that's actually it.
Do we have any questions?
So you just said we can use SSH copy ID to copy all of our keys to a server. Would it make sense to have like different SSH keys for different servers, or is that not really that important?
Yeah. I should probably correct it a bit. So you can copy all your public keys to a server, but of course it makes you, if you have many public keys, you might restrict. Like if I have one very important server, I probably don't want all of my keys there. I don't need the FIDO protected keys or whatnot. So for sure, if you actually do this on a more, not on just a hobby level, then you should not just randomly copy keys. Yeah.
Thanks for the talk. I was wondering, do you know, having looked at the protocol, if you don't verify the server's public key, but you're using public key authentication, so the server knows your public key, but you don't know it. Can somebody actually do a man-in-the-middle attack, or could they just give you a fake shell? Like, obviously, they could give you a different server, so you try to log in, and the man-in-the-middle just gives you a different server completely. You can't authenticate the server, but it seems like the encryption could be reliant on your authentication key in some way, and I'm wondering if you know if SSH does that. Like, if you're a man in the middle and the user doesn't know the server's public key, can you actually man in the middle them when they're using public key authentication?
Yeah. So what you are going to sign the session identifier hash, right? And that should point uniquely to my current session. So that would be towards the real server or towards a completely fake man in the middle server. So if I haven't checked, if I don't know the server's public key and I'm connecting to a wrong server, I'm not sure. I think I will have to draw it, but I think, you know, I would be cheated, but you cannot take my proof and forward it to the other server. Yeah.
Yes, I agree with that. So the server key is in the key exchange phase, which is quite early, way before there is any authentication of the client going on. Mm. And once the client gets an authentication challenge for the public key, it will sign it, right?
Mm.
And there's no verification of the server anymore at that stage.
Yeah. Yeah.
Any more questions? Oh, don't spoil any slides. Let's give Nikolai another round of applause for a fantastic talk.